Hello, everyone, and welcome into Debate Night. We're in like a little temporary in-between studios area. Behind me, if you peek behind the curtain, I don't know if you can, actually. Nope, there's nothing back there. That's the Debate Night studio, or the Grip Lock studio. It used to be the Debate Night studio behind me. We're going to be building the Debate Night studio on this wall to my left. What I'm sitting in right now is going to be like the live stream, companion stream type studio, but we're just kind of making it all work right now. Very stressful few minutes leading up to this for Silas, but as far as I know, you can hear me and everything's good. So I'm not going to even look at chat. I'm just going to assume everything's good. But we got Brody calling in from Vegas a mere 2 days before your season starts. How are you feeling out there, Brody?
I first want to say thanks to everyone joining live tonight. Happy Tuesday, 2/22/22. It was a glorious day. And I actually just posted something on Instagram with me and Ezra where we played hole number two at Innova at 2/22 and we both got twos in a twosome.
Jeez. So twoception. You should have played the hole 22 times and twoed it every time.
Today was not the greatest day to play disc golf.
Why?
It was 30 mile per hour winds out here.
Oh.
It was one of the windier rounds I've ever played in.
Not to make you jealous or anything, but yesterday out here was 66 and sunny, and I played a round of golf in shorts and a t-shirt, and it was incredible.
When was the last time you've done that? Like 5 months?
It's been a few. Well, I mean, I wasn't playing golf 5 months ago, so if last time I played golf in shorts and a t-shirt is years.
Yeah, exactly. My point.
So speaking of the course, though, are there any major changes that you've noticed on like this course versus last year's?
Someone said audio only left speaker. I don't know what that means. But as long as they can hear us, I guess that's
yeah, good, I mean, right? At this point, if you can hear us, just take your right headphone out. Maybe we'll have to go with that. Silas will figure it out. I hope.
We'll eventually get all this settled to where I don't have to fly back to do Debate Night every Tuesday.
Maybe that's the best solution. Silas, it might just be a mono. It might be a mono channel in OBS.
Wait, but
someone else is saying that might just be their thing too.
Okay, thank goodness.
Let us know in the chat. Let us know in the chat.
Silas will monitor the chat. You just talk about the course, Brody.
Okay. Let me talk about the course. So yeah, a lot of different changes this year, with not only tee pads, but also pin placements. And also moving some holes that were fives to fours and some holes that were fours to threes. Mm. So nothing I've seen besides maybe one hole I can think of might have gotten a little bit easier to birdie, but brings in a bogey into play. So
interesting.
To me, I think they did a great job with hearing some of the feedback from players or fans or whoever left feedback, and they changed a lot of the holes that were kind of either really soft par fours or kind of like in between. If you remember the one hole on Factory last year where I think they mentioned where it was like a 45 minute backup for a lot of people.
Yeah. People could allegedly someone went and like played a few, played like a hand of blackjack or something at the casino and came back. That might've been years ago, but that hole.
Yeah. Where it's just basically a blind shot and people are just chucking these flex shots over the top. And, they made that into like a little dinker kind of straight shot, but there's rocks in front to where you can't really slide up to the basket and there's trees to where you kind of have to go under. But it's like a 300 foot shot or something. So pace of play, I think will be much better, especially on that hole. But all in all, I've really liked the changes. I've played a couple rounds now with, Calvin, Ezra, Yuli, Scott Stokely. And from all the people I've talked to so far, everyone seems to like it. The big thing with Vegas, right, is the three courses.
Yeah.
That's the big kind of kicker of having to try to prepare for 54 different holes.
Mm-hmm.
They did do a little bit better job, I would say, scheduling this year where they made it to have specific time blocks. Time blocks to where you have to like only this division can be on this course at that time. So for example, today after 9:30, if you get out there super early, you can play whatever course you want. But after 9:30, the only people that were going to be on Innova was MPO.
Nice.
So it makes it nice for the MPO to where we're not sharing the course with a bunch of people that might just be out there to have fun. And, you know, we also too want that separation to where we're not putting people that are playing this tournament as like a fun vacation or a fun trip. And all of a sudden they've got people on their butt that are like trying to play through and all this. They can come out and enjoy the round and not be with the people that are, you know, doing it for a living as well. So they definitely have changed a couple things. They also, I think, made a correction or not a correction, but made sure that everyone knew about the filming and all that stuff, which I know last year was an issue. And all in all, so far, the one thing I'll say too, and it'll be interesting to see if you guys pick up on this watching it on coverage, I'm not sure how many spectators are going to be there, but if there are a lot of spectators, I think the one thing you will see is they've done a really good job of separating the spectators from the actual course, to where there was moments where I looked and I was like, this looks exactly like a golf tournament.
Nice.
Where they've got the little fences with the ropes and stuff,
yeah,
to where spectators can kind of walk. They've got paths to where people aren't just going to be meandering and walking all over the place. So, and I don't know if that's a Disc Golf Pro Tour thing or if that is a Innova Las Vegas challenge. But it was very, very nice to see. And yeah, I'm excited, man. It's gonna be one heck of a tournament, I can tell you that much.
Yeah, I was actually looking through the to hit on a few different points you just talked about. I was looking through the caddy book today, preparing for the Grip Locked preview show tomorrow that will go over all the nitty gritty of the tournament and get everyone ready for the coverage. I was going through the caddy book and reading line by line, figuring out every detail of the tournament I could. And one of the things I noticed was, like, in the added cash, they had like a little section next to it that said that, like, it was an expense of like $45,000 and was just said for spectator accommodations. Now, after that, it did say that as of the publishing of the caddy sheet, the spectator pass sales were lower than expected. So hopefully that turns around. But yeah, I don't know. Spectator accommodations, I mean, 45 grand, that's no joke. I don't know if that's going to like what you said, because they also had like...
I hope not.
No, they had like
an event. I hope it's not going to...
They had an events company, I forget what it's called, that had donated like $10,000, and most of it was for fencing and stuff like that. Like, not $10,000, $10,000 of value, and most of it was for like fencing and barriers and stuff like that, it said. I didn't know what that was going to be for, but that's probably what you're talking about. The 45 grand, the best I can assume, is the rental of the property, is all I could think of for the week or weekend.
Yeah. I mean, I do know the cost of renting out the entire course is probably fairly expensive.
Yeah. So that's all I could think of, because when you looked at the added cash, there was like 300,000 of added value to the tournament. 78,000 of it was added cash. 20,000 of that went to the pro purses across Elite Series and all of that. 45,000 of it went to this spectator accommodations, whatever that means. And then they were hoping $10,000 more would be added as it got closer to the weekend, but they were trying to be like more conservative when looking at the payout. But and then the other thing that I noticed in the caddy book that kind of plays into what you said was, with the three courses, they alluded to if the Las Vegas Challenge is back on the Pro Tour next year, that it won't be three courses. It'll be changing to two courses. And they also alluded to the AM weekend getting pulled back a week off of the weekend of the Pro weekend. So it sounds like whoever's out there, whether that's the Pro Tour forcing their hand or just the Las Vegas Challenge themselves, it seems like they're at least listening to the critiques and stuff like that from players. But as you've been playing, I do want to ask one final question, and then we'll get into some topics I have for tonight.
Before you jump into that, though, I will say the only thing that I'm kind of questioning or thinking about, not in a positive way.
Uh-huh.
Because everything I've seen so far from 2022 so far has been awesome.
Yeah,
is the payout.
Yeah,
that's the only thing where $4,000 for an Elite Series win on the Disc Golf Pro Tour seems very low.
Well, yeah, like I said, that it seems like they don't have the full financial thing ready. So when they posted that in the caddy sheet, it says that it's a conservative estimate and that the final one would be posted Sunday morning.
Oh.
So hopefully come Sunday morning, that number's gone up.
Did not know that.
If it stays the same, I fully agree with you. Because last year, Eagle won and took home $5,500, so $1,500 more. And I believe Paige won last year by one stroke over Cat, and she took home $500 more than the FPO winner this year is going to take with the original published numbers that we have right now. But at, like in it, they said they're hoping at least $10,000 more will be added to the Elite Series purse. And with that, you know, obviously the whole payout will change. So before I throw into too much judgment.
Yeah, no, thanks for that update on that, because that obviously changes. But
yeah,
what do you think should be like the bare minimum for an Elite Series?
Because
I think there's 14 or 13 Elite Series.
Yeah.
And let's just talk MPO, because obviously FPO, some of the fields change and stuff. But for MPO, what do you think, like, if you win an Elite Series Disc Golf Pro Tour event, what should the bare minimum in an ideal world be walking away with?
I think an ideal world, then we're talking 10 grand minimum, because at the current state of the purse, if you restructure, I've talked about this so many times last season, and I'm trying to hold myself back since it's the beginning of the season. I know I'm going to talk about it throughout the season. I don't want to make everyone sick. If you restructure the money that's already in the pot, you could be paying out the winner $10,000 as is right now. Like, you just have to restructure, make it more top heavy. So to me, in an ideal world, $10,000. But in the world that it's currently operating in financial wise, where we, instead of going top heavy, we spread it out a little bit more, then I think realistically $6,000 is the minimum. I don't see a reason that a Pro Tour event could run and not at least pay the winner $6,000. I think that's reasonable.
Okay.
But yeah, I would be surprised if there was a tournament that I plugged into the payout calculator we use and it didn't spit back a number close to $10,000 at me. It's just that right now tournaments don't go top heavy, because the biggest difference is like the last cash right now gets $400, and if you plug into that calculator, last cash will get like $245. So it's like a $150 difference at the bottom to make a, what is it, $6,000 difference at the top?
So if I crunch the numbers in my head and just do like a little estimation, if someone were to clean sweep all Elite Series and all four majors and the Tour Championship, they're taking home less than $200,000.
How many tournaments are there?
20. Well, no, there's like 14. There's either 13 or 14 Elite Series.
Yeah.
There's four majors, and then there's the Tour Championship.
So yeah,
round up to 20, and you take the average at $10,000 winning.
Yeah.
You know, 200 grand.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's probably a fair estimate.
Put something in perspective.
It wouldn't surprise me if the winner of the Pro Tour Championship this year walked away with $50,000. Last year was 30. They've talked about already. They're hoping to up it.
That's a good question. Do you think they should be putting more money? Because again, like obviously, if it's sponsorships.
Yeah.
And the sponsors, and they're able to sell the Tour Championship more than these other tournaments, and that's what's jacking up the purse. But if it's something of where they're like, they have like a pot or something that they're putting in money throughout the year for the Tour Championship, do you think they should continue to try to raise the Tour Championship winning number to like 50, 60, 70 or whatever? Or should they try to spread that out amongst the Elite Series events?
I think where it's at right now, like $30,000 to win the Pro Tour Championship, let's park there and spread any additional money out as much as we can. If that's what's happening, if it is like Johnsonville and LL Bean and all those people come in, and you know, the Tour Championship's just massive. only thing that makes me question that is like, how is it so much easier to sell a tour championship than Worlds when like we know Worlds has more eyeballs on it? Like there's no way the tour championship got more views than Worlds.
The Disc Golf Pro Tour, are they a part of trying to sell that? Or is that the PDGA is trying to sell it?
The tournament itself would be the PDGA because the Disc Golf Network's handling the coverage, but the PDGA would
handle
it.
They're not trying to sell it. Okay.
Correct. So it might just be maybe the sales team at the Pro Tour is that much better than the sales team at Worlds. Maybe that's what it comes down to. I don't know. But no, I agree. I mean, if it's something where we like have a little side pot going and throughout the year we're, you know, chucking just extra money into it to get the Pro Tour championship number built up, I understand the thought behind that because it gives like more of a marketing push when you can say like the winner of the Pro Tour championship gets 50 grand, 60 grand, whatever. Yeah. And there a lot of eyeballs are going to come from that. But I think the like longer term better move for the sport is get it where like players are winning $10,000-$15,000 week in and week out. And then a chance to win 30 or 40 at the end of the year, and just keep that end of the year number like double what the normal winning of a Pro Tour event is. And then as it grows, just grow them both like that versus just grow one as big as it can go. And the rest of the tour is like, yeah, I mean, if you win the Pro Tour championship, you get 150 grand. But if you win DDO or GBO,
some other tournament,
yeah,
you get $6,000.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think that's the best way to move forward, but with the Las Vegas Challenge, I do want to know one final thing of this. This might not be true, but in my head, this is like one of the first tournaments you're like coming back to, right? Or is this the third year you played Las Vegas?
No.
It was the second year?
Yeah. First year started at Waco.
Yeah. So coming back to Las Vegas this year, have you noticed like, oh, wow, this hole is so much easier than I thought it was last year or anything like that?
There may only be one hole in the entire tournament layout, so all 54 holes. There might be only one hole, and it's wind dependent that I'm not trying to birdie.
Mm.
And I want to say last year there were probably a decent handful of holes that I was strategically playing for par.
Yeah,
and then there was another handful of holes where a birdie just wasn't possible.
Mm.
So yeah, I mean, I've noticed a definitely a big difference. I also just might have figured out, I got to like get that feeling back, but I might have figured out how to finally throw a nose down hyzer forehand.
Uh oh, that could be trouble for the tour.
Granted, it was downwind, but it went about 550 feet.
Holy
crap. Yeah, it was downwind though. So
yeah, I mean, yeah.
But that's one throw that I'm really struggling with is every time I try to throw a hyzer forehand, I just get back into the ultimate frisbee mode and throw it nose up.
Yeah.
And I might have finally, I think I finally like got one to like work. And so tomorrow I'll be definitely spending a lot of time in the field working on that. But yeah, I mean, that's one of the more fun for the listeners right now that are just getting into disc golf, or maybe you've been playing disc golf for a while and now you're starting to take it more seriously and you're getting better. That's probably one of the best feelings, is going to a course that you've played before and knowing that you've gotten better and then coming back to that course and playing it again and being like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Wow. Like a hole 18 at Waco, for example, is going to be a perfect example for this, of where last year, I mean, I was pretty much out of it when I went for it the final round.
Yeah.
And I was like shocked that I cleared it, right?
Yeah, the whole way you didn't think it was going over.
I'm probably throwing like a force on hyzer.
Yeah.
To get there this year. So the distances are definitely the easiest ones to see. And then also the cool thing is like sometimes when you're really struggling on consistency, like gaps look really, really small. And then when you're feeling good about your throws, gaps look a lot bigger.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll sometimes get to a hole where you're like, oh my gosh, I thought this gap was super, super small. And now, you know, it feels much more doable. So it's always fun to do that. And yeah, I mean, this year especially there's going to be so many courses that I'm coming back to for the second time, that it's also nice because I'm not having to try to figure out what discs do and how to play a hole. This year, I already know what my discs are doing, and I've already played the hole, so it's a lot easier to get these practice rounds in.
Yeah, you're actually just going out and practicing and not trying to figure out, like, do field work and practice at the same time.
Exactly.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, I'm definitely excited for the tournament to start. But I've got a few different topics here that I want to at least get opinions on and see if they don't spark a little debate. One, I actually wasn't even planning to be a topic, but I mean, it happened a few minutes ago and I found it absolutely hilarious. And so I just wanted to bring it up because, like, why the heck not? So it happened over on Facebook. I took it to Twitter because that's just what happens. MVP Discs posted on their, like, main Facebook page this meme. It's the Anakin meme where, you know, who is it? Princess Leia is like, so they basically Anakin's
Emma. No, is that Padme?
Padme. Yep. Don't.
Yeah, Padme.
I've watched. It's been a long time since I watched Star Wars.
Clearly not a Star Wars person.
No, jeez. I'm not a Star Wars person. Anyways, you get the meme. So it's Innova saying, "We'd like to use your media," and then she's like, "You'll give me credit, right?" And then it's Innova, and then she says, "Right." And then MVP says, "Hey, Innova Discs, this you? Looks like you might owe our guy Jahani Vino a tag, and should maybe check your DMs." I probably butchered his name. That's not the point of this, though. And then put dash MVP Steve, who is their marketing director. Trevor actually has an interview with him coming out Thursday. So perfect timing on Trevor's part.
Who is the person in the post they're referring to?
So he is the guy that was at the Olympics that got the gold medal and then threw the shot through the Olympic rings.
Okay.
So basically, he posted that.
So that's what the clip is.
Yeah. So here's what I've read through a bunch of different comments trying to figure this all out. And in a disc golf debate group, someone explained. They said they heard this straight from MVP Steve, but I didn't hear it straight from him. So this is like me hearing it through someone who says they heard it through him, but it makes perfect sense. So basically,
TMZ.
Yeah, you know me. But basically, what they said the situation is essentially Innova did reach out to him and said, "Hey, do you mind if we repost this?" He responded and said, "No problem at all. Just tag me and tag MVP in it." And then they posted it and didn't tag him or MVP. But put it like
he's sponsored by MVP.
Yeah. So then Innova put a comment, but it was just like the video emoji and then his name. They didn't tag him in it. And then apparently since then, MVP has been privately behind the scenes trying to DM Innova, be like, "Hey, you know, you said you would tag us in it, you didn't, no response." And he has been privately DMing them, same thing, no response. So now they're both being ghosted, and that's why MVP took it public on Facebook. That's the explanation that happened over on Facebook. Realistically, whether or not that's the exact nitty-gritty of what happened, you know, not 100% sure because I didn't hear that straight from the person. But regardless, absolutely savage from MVP to post that on their actual Facebook page, not just like, you know, this guy posted on his personal page and whatever. Like, this is like just straight up from one company coming after another company. And I'm not going to lie to you. I kind of love it. I kind of dig it. I'm here for that stuff. That's, you know, disc golf has always been like buddy-buddy, you know, let's all hold hands and sing kumbaya. And like, you know, it's okay to have a little hard-nosed, smash-mouth social media every once in a while. Why not?
Yeah, well, I also don't think it's going to be buddy-buddy, too, with the money situation. Like, obviously, money changes everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's nuts because that was something that used to happen all the time back in the day when social media was very, very new.
Yeah.
It still happens a little bit now with a lot of these, like, either meme pages or some of these other, like, not House of Highlights, but pages like that are basically, they basically just go out and find clips and then they blast it out themselves.
Yeah.
It's nuts when, like, you actually go through the process of asking someone if you can use it, and then the comment section, like, tag is the clear thing of, like, because I've done this before too in posts, so it's not like I don't know what they're doing.
Yeah,
I've done it too, where it's like you want to say like, oh no, you got tagged, I tagged you, but you don't want it to be thrown in the actual caption.
Yeah.
It's a slimy move.
Oh, they didn't even tag him. They just put his name.
Okay. Well, that's even worse. I think the big story here, though, is like you said, is not so much Iniva. It's more like the fact that MVP publicly has called them out.
Yeah.
Because I'm with you on that. I think I don't mind the buddy situation for certain things, but at a certain point, a little too much kumbaya and everyone sitting around the campfire making s'mores, I'm not too interested in it. So I like it.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, it was definitely – when I saw it – well, first off, I saw someone tweet it, and then I was like, that can't be real. Like, surely that's a meme. So then I went over to Facebook and saw it from my own eyes, and I was like, oh, my gosh, it's right there. And then I scrolled through, like, comments, and the only thing I think that was bad about it is the full context wasn't provided. So, like, some people are getting mad at MVP, calling them crybabies and, like, back and forth. But, you know, no, that's what happens.
That's a funny thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people, obviously, if you have – you know, crazy Iniva like fans, like they're not gonna. You can't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
I saw something today that was very interesting. Talking about, and I don't want to get too much into talking about pros behavior and all that stuff on tour, but it's in the same notion of people talking about. I think they brought up Eric Oakley and Nico, and he was saying how he had like watched a bunch of coverage. And a lot of the things that people get upset about Nico doing, Eric Oakley was doing. Mm. But yet no one really goes after Eric Oakley. And he was basically saying, like, why is that? Is it because he's more on social media? Or is he known as this friendly guy or whatever it may be? But I think, I mean, you're always going to have some people that they're going to, you know, turn their head or
turn a blind eye.
And some people can't do anything wrong. So
yeah,
but I love it, man. I think there needs to be more competition, especially if you're a fan out there. There needs to be more competition in these disc golf companies because that's what drives price down, and that's what gives better product.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a reason why you can't have a monopoly on certain things is because it causes the fact that prices go, it's just bad for the customer. It's bad for the consumer. So,
well, I think that's
up, are good things.
No, absolutely. Up to this point, back to your like Nico point, I think Nico has somewhat gotten a bad rep just because his reputation and like in a world where disc golf up to this point has been so buddy-buddy and picture-perfect and is what it is, Nico was one of the people that didn't care to a certain degree and, you know, just wore his heart on his sleeve to a fault at times. And so people, like, it kind of became the thing that, like, when you're watching Nico under a microscope, when all these other players, you weren't, because even the players are sometimes watching Nico under a microscope. So things that Nico does that every other player on tour does, literally, if Nico does it, then it becomes an issue or then it gets pushed to the forefront where when Paul does it, Ricky does it, Eagle does it. I mean, for Pete's sake, last year, Nico kicked a mini and everyone blew up and freaked out. And a tournament earlier, Eagle fully ripped a whale sack at his bag and there was like one funny post made about it and that was it. And so I think that's kind of Nico's got the bad side of that. But as the sport progresses and goes forward, more and more competition is going to draw like more and more tension, and more tension is going to cause not just Nico to be looked under the microscope, but then, you know, the Paul fans are going to be looking at Ricky under the microscope, and the Eagle fans are going to be looking at so-and-so under the microscope. And then it just becomes like, you know, normal sports where you have people who hate Grayson Allen no matter what. And then you have people like me who are going to defend Grayson Allen, even when I look like an idiot, just because I'm a Grayson Allen fan. And that's why this, you know, immediate thing here with Iniva and MVP was so hard for me. Is because I, like, deep in my blood, I'm an Iniva simp, like, through and through. I love Iniva. They're plastic everything. Mm-hmm. But then recently, I've become an MVP, like, follower, gyro knot, whatever you want to call me. So seeing them both butt heads, I'm just kind of sitting on a fence. I don't know where to go. I'm looking both ways. I'm like, yeah, MVP, how dare you? But then I'm like, well, Iniva, you really screwed my guys over here. So I'm just kind of in the middle here. being pulled both sides. It's like I'm going through a divorce right now. It's crazy.
I think MVP actually might have something going right now because there really isn't a disc golf manufacturing company that is really using social media in a creative way, in the sense of like doing something outside the norm. You know, someone, a company that does an incredible job of this is like Wendy's.
Yeah.
If you ever want like a good time, just go to Wendy's Twitter.
Heck yeah.
And they have posts on there all the time that are absolutely hilarious. No one's really doing that right now. And if you look at all of them, they're all pretty much posting the same thing. It's either about their players or it's about discs coming out.
Yeah.
It's about tournaments. And, you know, if MVP finds something of where they want to be a little bit more edgy on social media,
Yeah, sure.
I'm sure it might turn some people off, but it also might get a lot of people talking about you. So
It's like Duolingo.
It'll be interesting to see what happens.
It's like Duolingo on TikTok. Like exactly who on earth was Duolingo? But what they started doing was just they just made hilarious TikToks that had nothing to do with their app, but also were just like they'd roast people left and right and whatever. And it was just the their mascot's this big green owl, and what they are is a language.
Who are you talking about?
Duolingo. They're a language app, but they went viral on TikTok time and time again. They're the Wendy's of TikTok essentially. Because they just they found their niche. They were able to just kind of separate themselves, like what you were saying. And look what just happened. I just told you about Duolingo. If you want to learn Spanish, go there. We could have people doing that for MVP all over the place.
I'm more of a Rosetta Stone guy, so
not anymore. Hey, go to their TikTok. You'll ditch Rosetta Stone real quick. One of MVP's claims to fame is the gyro adds distance, adds glide, right? But one of your most recent things, this is a great segue. Yeah, one of your most recent things is...
I'm out.
Oh, wait, do you agree with me now?
I've changed my mind.
Oh, let's hear this. Explain your original point.
Okay, my original point is glide should not exist as a... I'm still on the glide should not exist in the flight numbers.
Okay.
I'm still on it.
Okay.
Okay? And I'm on it because... The actual mold of the disc has little to do with the glide, more so than dome. I think dome has more to do with the glide than the actual mold. And I'll tell you why, because I literally have been throwing these discs. I've been throwing a lot of discs recently and a lot of like different ones. And I've noticed that discs that fly like two nukes that have very similar flight characteristics in the sense of like actually to the visible eye, how they flip up and fly.
Mm-hmm.
What the nuke that like Ezra gave me, this nuke goes so far, so much further than this other nuke. And the only difference between the two, same plastic, all that. The only difference between the two is the dome. One's domey and one's flatter. So that's where I think when you talk about glide, the glide number is going to be the same for both those nukes. However, the glide is not the same.
Yeah.
So that's why I think you just get rid of the glide completely, because really, ultimately, too, a disc that is really, really overstable, that has a lot of fade, a high fade number, is going to have far less glide than a disc that doesn't have a lot of fade, right? So like something like a Buzz, for example, is going to have a lot more glide than a disc like a drone that wants to just try to work itself out. If you throw them both flat, again, I'm going off of throwing discs flat.
Sure.
If you throw them both flat, the Buzz is going to travel further than the drone, because as soon as you throw it flat, it's trying to get to the ground, where the Buzz is just flying forward. That was my original argument.
Yeah.
But when it comes to especially distance drivers, because you don't really ever see, and this is interesting, why don't you see as many like domey fairways?
You do.
Not nearly as much though. I've never like had like a pop top Undertaker. I've had a little bit.
Well, you've only thrown discraft, like T-birds or domey all the time, leopards, rivers. I've had some really domey F5s. I've had some great FVs.
Same dome as a distance driver?
Yeah. I've had pop top T-birds. I've actually had T-birds that have more dome than a Destroyer.
I don't think I've ever had like a pop top Raptor.
Well, no, I've ever had a lot of Innova's.
Why is that?
It's just the mold. The mold has a lot to do with the. So what you're saying makes somewhat sense.
Undertakers and Heats. Yes, I've had domey Undertakers and Heats. Like Avenger SS. I don't know if I've had a domey Avenger SS.
No, they don't really ever run with dome. It's kind of like a zone. If a zone, there's been like one zone run in all of our years of getting discs in that has had dome. They're pretty much all board flat because the mold, whatever it is about, I don't know the full process.
Doesn't allow it?
It either doesn't allow it or like something along it encourages it to be flat. And there's some discs like that just are encouraged to be more flat. Whereas there are other discs like a river. I've never felt a river that wasn't domey, but the river has six glide. That's like its big thing is it's very glidey fairway driver. And so therefore, like you're saying, is a lot of that is attributed to the dome. I'll agree with that statement. But
that's tricky though. Like nukes, like that's the disc that, you know, I throw the most.
But wouldn't you say the issue is that you can get two nukes that fly differently? Isn't that more of a consistency issue versus a glide number issue?
Well, no, I'm saying like, do they then need to almost make, does Discraft almost need to make two different discs? Like, or you make a disc, you call it like, take out glide, right? Take that number out. And you say, this is the nuke F, which means flat. And this is the nuke D, which means dome. Because like what you were saying, you were just saying a bunch of molds that essentially just have either they're always domey or they're flat. But like a nuke, I have nukes that are board flat and I have nukes that are extremely domey. So do you think when it comes to that, to a mold that they know can go one way or the other, do they almost have to like distinguish between the two? Because that's where I'm at right now. It's like, I think dome has way more to do, like a domey force, for example, is going to fly further and stay in the air longer than a flat nuke.
Yeah, I mean that's probably true. I think the reason you see the inconsistency with it more in distance driver, and again I could be wrong here, but I'm pretty sure a distance driver typically has a thinner flight plate. The middle of the disc is thinner versus like a putter is the thickest, mid's a little thinner, fairway's a little thinner, and then the distance driver. So when the disc is settling after coming out, it depends a lot on like the factory condition or like temperature in the air and stuff like that. From what I've understood, that will change how it settles into the mold and the dome in the middle. And since it's thinner, that is why it varies more in distance drivers. The only issue is like they might have 3 weeks straight where every nuke that comes out is domey, and they want a nuke F or whatever they call it. They want the flat nuke. And so, like, it might be something where it's hard to get the flat nuke consistently with whatever's going on, whereas, like, they're both nukes. You know, for the majority of the population, they're both going to fly very, very similar. It's just once you get...
Majority of the population, yeah.
Yeah, it's just once you get to, like, an elite level. But then again, once you get to an elite level, you're feeling... Or, yeah, sure. But I still think there's discs that exist from... And you might have to go manufacturer to manufacturer... that have very similar fade, so like how far left they finish, but one has more glide, so it has like a pushing fade versus the other ones like a drone or a zone or anything like that where it has like a dumpy finish. And so the glide's important in that aspect because it's like how long the disc wants to stay in the air while still going left. That's why I can't agree. I think flight numbers absolutely, they mean nothing in general because every company has a different one. So like a 7-speed at Discraft isn't a 7-speed at Latitude, which isn't a 7-speed at Prodigy, which isn't a 7-speed at Innova. So like, what the heck do they even mean? That's not part of this conversation. It's if we're using them, I think glide should be one of the numbers if we're using it. Just because like, I think it's at least a good number to understand like a very overstable disc is going to have less glide, but a very like far flying or neutral flying disc might still have that fade, but it'll have more glide. So I, as a consumer, can understand, oh, this disc is meant to stay in the air longer, even though it's still going to be overstable, versus, oh, this disc is going to get to the ground faster and be overstable.
Yeah. I think until we can get a machine that can consistently shoot discs out with, and we can affect how fast they go out, and we can also affect the amount of spin.
Yeah.
Because those two things matter a lot. If we can get a machine that does that, I think that video breaks the internet.
No,
because
yeah.
Then all of a sudden, then all of a sudden you can literally say, all right, we're going to throw, you know, what are two discs that people talk about all the time? Like in different manufacturers that people say like are the same disc.
I mean, back in the day, people always argued between the Buzz and the Rock 3, but like the Rock 3 is beated.
Perfect.
But you could at least see which one actually goes farther and stuff like that.
Yeah. Does the Berg actually fall out of the
there
sky?
There you go. Does the Berg actually have no glide?
You put the Berg against like the Roach or something that has an insane amount of glide, and you launch it, everything's the same, and then all of a sudden you find out like they both went 300 feet.
No, the Berg definitely has less glide than a Roach. 100%. 100%.
All right.
75%.
All right.
10% sure that the Berg has less glide. No, I do notice that I have
Firebird
to throw it harder.
Firebird Raptor would be good.
Firebird's too. Way That'd more overstable. Good. It'd be like Firebird Captain Raptor. That's comparable. All right, another big thing that came out today, I believe. Yeah, it was today. Wow, long day. The Pro Tour media partnership deals have been announced. The Pro Tour has announced that they have signed a multi-year deals with Jomez and Gatekeeper for the men's lead and chase card coverage. It also looks like GK Pro has a single-year deal for the women's lead card coverage. And then Central Coast has lead card at Silver Series events. But the big deal that came out of all of this was Jomez has purchased the rights to the lead card coverage for the next two seasons for $500,000, so $250,000 a season for the rights to be able to cover these rounds. So we talked about this previously.
What is it? Silver Series 2?
No,
or
Silver
is
Series
just...
is Central Coast. So it's just the main Pro Tour events.
And they're doing... They added... There's a couple... majors on there too.
I don't know if the Pro Tour wouldn't have access to those.
No, the Disc Golf Network does.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe Jomez will handle USDGC post-produced, but
that
was
on there. Was it not on there
in today's post?
Today's post was simply just Disc Golf Pro Tour. That's it.
I can look it up right here. I thought so. We're excited to announce our 2022 post-production media plan. Welcome back. Hit the link in our bio. Let me hit the link in our bio. Because this just says Pro Tour two-year deal. Because the Pro Tour had announced earlier...
12 events.
The Pro Tour had announced earlier about the Disc Golf Network covering USDGC, Worlds, Champions Cup, all of that.
Are they doing the playoffs as well?
Yeah, it just says for the Pro Disc Golf Pro Tour season.
So we're assuming it's by playoffs and... Okay, so I'm going to do some numbers here.
Wait. While this constitutes the current season-long partnership, more post-production will provide additional coverage throughout the season. FPO chase card coverage will be added whenever possible and is planned for all PDGA majors. Jomez, groundbreaking. They will provide coverage for three PDGA majors. The PDGA Worlds, USWDGC, and Champions Cup.
Okay, so they're doing 30. They're doing 36 events. 15 is going to be the 12 Elite Series, the two playoffs, and then the Tour Championships. So that's 15. 15 the next year, and then that's 30, and then the six majors across the 2 years. So that's 36. So you do that divided by 36, so just under $14,000 a tournament.
Yeah,
is what they're paying. Which most tournaments are roughly 3 days.
Yeah.
So they're paying right around $4,600 or so a day.
And that's two videos
cover,
each day.
Mm-hmm. That's to cover lead card.
I did some math on just like rough.
I mean,
numbers.
They're gonna. Can we talk about the first and the most ridiculous thing that you told me? Can I bring that up, or do you want to bring it up?
I don't know, so bring it up.
that you were saying that you saw in some comments.
Oh, yeah.
That people thought that the Disc Golf Pro Tour was paying Jomez.
Yeah.
And instead of being like, what the heck is going on? People are like, yeah, finally, the Disc Golf Pro Tour paying Jomez what they deserve.
Yeah, it was also, like, it was the
that
way.
What are you thinking?
So Ulti World posted it says, Jomez is back covering lead card for MPO for the next 2 years after agreeing to a $500,000 rights fee in a Milestone Media contract. Nothing they said in that was wrong, but they were the first ones to like put the number into the post that was on social media because the Pro Tour's post didn't have, you had to go looking for it. And so people were like responding to it and also sharing it. And now people are like starting to understand it, but the initial things were like not enough, but you know, it's a good start. And like I saw someone share it and they're like, great to see, like good to see for Jomez. You know, this is really big for them, which it is, but you could tell by the way people were wording it and some of their responses that people initially were like, oh, sick. The Pro Tour is paying Jomez what they deserve. Versus like the Pro Tour owns the rights to this and Jomez is paying it. From the rough math I did, this shouldn't be like the Jomez is getting, I don't want to call it a steal, but Jomez should have no problem making the money back on YouTube AdSense alone.
Well, I mean, they're going to make, they've already made that money in Patreon, right? So like
I didn't even look at Patreon.
You don't even have to look. So like this is what I think is a good move for both, right? Because one, they are the only company right now on the media side that is interested in paying that kind of money for coverage.
Well, maybe. Because I would assume Gatekeeper, they also are Gatekeeper and Jomez are the only two that are under a 2-year deal in the announcement. So,
but Gatekeeper didn't have the money. I bet, I don't know if there was a bidding war between the
two. That's what I'm saying. It's weird to me. There's a few things that I don't know, I'm assuming I can't say, that I like was looking at behind the scenes that were confusing, and it kind of makes sense a little bit now, that make me feel as though this wasn't decided until very recently.
Don't tell me anything, because I hate knowing stuff that I can't talk about.
I will. It's nothing big. It's just something I saw weeks ago, and I was like, that's kind of weird. And then now looking back on it, I'm like, oh, this would make sense if this wasn't already set in stone. Like if this was something that was ongoing negotiation. But I do think that Gatekeeper must have paid for Chase card coverage. Maybe they were like, don't put that number out publicly or whatever. But it's hard to imagine a world where Gatekeeper or whoever doesn't want the lead card coverage. And so at some point there's going to be a bidding war if that's not what already happened. It might have been like, hey, you know, this is what, you know, Jomez, what are you willing to pay for this? And Jomez comes back with X amount. And then they're like, all right, Gatekeeper, you know, just to let you know, like, if you want to top this, you can. And maybe Gatekeeper was like, yeah, we can definitely do it. We can top it. And they came back and it went back and forth until eventually Gatekeeper's like, that's too big of a risk. But Jomez is like, hey, we know our fans have us. We know they're going to back us. It is what it is.
My point meaning, like, Jomez is the only one that is willing to, I mean, obviously Gatekeeper, if they really wanted it, they could have probably paid $700,000. Now, would Jomez go over top of that as well? Who knows? Yeah. My point was just, there's no one else outside of maybe those two that, it's not like they're bidding against ESPN or ABC or CBS or ESPN Plus. They're not bidding against really any media company outside of disc golf. So I think this is a good thing for both, because obviously we were talking about this a while ago, where I still think down the road that it'll be interesting to see if the Disc Golf Pro Tour, and maybe they're in the world of where they're just like, hey, we just really want to focus on live, and trying to bring on post-produce and do all this is just too much for us. And it's easier for us right now to sell that for $500,000 and not have to worry about it and know Jomez is going to do a great job than trying to do that in-house. And yeah, we might be able to make 750 or a million or whatever, but maybe it's just easier for them to just focus on live and try to do live as best as possible and let these other people do post. Yeah. I'm wondering if that's what it is, because I still think they would be more successful financially and on social media as well, is if everything was on their site, on their channel, all that stuff, and everything drove traffic to them. But this has got to be something of where they just feel like it's too much work to get started and get going when there's already people out there doing it really well. But it's going to get really interesting is what happens a couple years from now.
Yeah, as I was going to say, 2023, that price
does come in.
Well, also 2023, that price is not going to be $500,000 anymore for 2 years. That's going to go up because as disc golf's popularity goes up, which, you know, UDisc just put out an article, it's not like pumping the brakes anytime soon as of right now, according to statistics. So
no, the COVID drop off thing was that whenever people were talking about that's not a realistic thing. Most people that are getting into disc golf also are not because of COVID. Like COVID definitely had an impact and definitely brought in a lot of new people as well. But there was also a lot of people getting into disc golf before COVID.
Yeah.
And also Ultimate Frisbee. A lot of people play Ultimate Frisbee. And now that easy transition from Frisbee over to disc golf, it wasn't because of COVID for a lot of these people. It's simply just because they're finding out about this sport that they didn't know about. And all of a sudden, like, wow, they're loving it. So
I think it's gonna be
really, really good for the disc golf pro tour.
Yeah, I think the COVID drop off, what it technically was, is I think it was something that was felt more so like on a retailer manufacturer side, because I think what happened was you had the boom.
That's more stimulus chips, though.
Exactly. I think it was a perfect storm because you had a lack of stock, a lack of inventory, stimulus checks. You had an influx of money into people's pockets who just learned about the sport, or people who already knew. And so if I'm a fan, I'm looking at a website and I see them get Onyxes in, I don't know when the next time I'm going to see an Onyx is. So now I might buy two or three times more of what I would normally buy because I have stimulus money and I don't know when the Onyx is going to be back in stock. So I think it might have like had this false sense of growth sales-wise that didn't match the actual growth of disc golf. So it made disc golf like sales numbers look bigger than they were. So then when those drop back down to meet reality, which is still much bigger than it was pre-pandemic and is still going up, it made it feel like there's this big, oh, people must have like dropped off, went back to work, whatever, stopped playing. When I think what actually happened was like people just started buying plastic at a normal rate again because, you know, the products started to get closer to meeting demand in today's market. But back to the Pro Tour Jomez thing, personally, I think this is the by far the smartest move the Pro Tour could have made for a number of reasons. A, I think the Pro Tour is probably crunching the numbers and realized the fact that like to be able to profit $500,000 off of post-production in the first year when you have to like front all the money for possibly additional equipment, more staff, you know, set up the logistics of editors, getting it turned around next day.
Do we know the payment? We don't know the payment method though.
What do you mean?
Oh, I was saying we don't know, like, I'm assuming that it's not $500,000 up front.
No. $250,000 per year, I'd assume, because it's $500,000 for 2 years. So I would guess it's like monthly thing or something.
Yeah, because I was going to say, do you think Jomez just wrote the Disc Golf Pro Tour $250,000 and now they're sitting with $250,000 in their bank account?
No, I would bet it's over months, but I bet the Pro Tour, obviously a contract, so the Pro Tour knows, like, they have that money coming in. It's now a new influx. But like that's probably something that it took a lot off of the Pro Tour's plate, where they don't have to apply staff, they don't have to hire more editors, they don't have to buy new cameras, they don't have to worry about, you know, more commentators and X, Y, and Z. A lot of like just logistical stuff behind the scenes that they don't have to worry about if they wanted to bring it in. And probably the biggest thing monetarily beneficial to the Pro Tour is they don't cut off Jomez. Because that had to be the thing that, like, if I'm the Pro Tour and I'm sitting back thinking about all these options, that's what I'm most scared of, is cutting off Jomez. Mm-hmm. Because Jomez is currently, and who knows when it won't be anymore, but they're the biggest, realistically, like the biggest brand social-wise in disc golf. Like, if you are in disc golf enough to follow people on social media, you're going to be following Jomez most likely, or at least have watched their videos. And so they have this diehard loyal fan base that the Pro Tour has went through this once in 2016, where cutting it off, you might even have players boycotting you because, and that happened. You had Nate Sexton, who in 2016 was like one of the top players. He's still a top name, but he was one of the top players boycotting the Pro Tour because the Pro Tour cut off Jomez and was like, hey, we're bringing it all in house. As the sport's gotten bigger, so has Jomez, so has Jomez's fan base, so has the, you know, players' careers that are now tied to Jomez. So you cut them off as the Pro Tour. That's a terrifying move. You have no idea the repercussions. Yeah, it could all be, you know, cupcakes and butterflies and it's all fine, but it also could be like you're risking who knows how much lost revenue, because there might be people who are paying Disc Golf Network. They're like, oh, what the heck, you're gonna cut off Jomez and be power hungry, I'm not subscribing to you anymore, then, you know, we're gonna take a boycott the Pro Tour. And then someone sweeps in, is like, hey, here's a tour, and we'll, Jomez, you're welcome to come in. And next thing you know, you've immediately created a competitor, whereas this way you secure money over the next 2 years. You secure great coverage for post-production because Jomez is the best at what they do. And you secure that the fan base of Jomez, one of the biggest, most powerful fan bases in disc golf, is still happy with you. I mean, those three things, it's a win-win-win for the Pro Tour. And for Jomez, this is job security for 2 years at least. Because now they don't have to have that in the back of their mind of like, hey, we're filming tournaments that someone else owns. So now, and Jonathan Gomez in the article even said this, like, who knows what Jomez is going to be capable of doing now that they know, hey, we can really invest in these next 2 years. We have 2 years of guaranteed growth. We can really invest in the company and grow it because we don't have to worry about growing this other stuff because coverage, our core thing, is locked in for 2 years. So, I mean, it's hard. Every year it's hard to imagine how Jomez's coverage can get better, but every year they've proven different ways to do it. So now that they have even more focused and more passion for 2 years with it locked in, there's no telling what that can mean for disc golf coverage and what that can mean overall for the growth of the sport. So to me, it was a great win for both sides because I think Jomez got it at a price where they're easily going to be able to make that money back and then some. And the Pro Tour got it at a price where it made sense on their bottom line and revenue to where it wasn't like, you know, we should have just invested in the all the back end stuff to do it ourselves. It's enough to like keep them happy to where it's worth it for them to give up all that potential money and to someone who's going to keep, you know, their fan base happy.
So here's an interesting thing to think about. So do you think Gatekeeper and we'll throw GK Pro in there as well. Do you think those two, and this is also for our listeners too, I would love to hear your guys' opinions on this too. So you can tweet us at Debate Night Pod on Twitter as well. Do you think Jomez Pro's product is exponentially better, like drastically better than Gatekeeper and GK Pro?
In some ways, I think the some of the things that Jomez is capable of is better, but it's not.
So if you went unbiased opinion though,
yeah,
like if you brought someone in that didn't know anything about disc golf, well, you know, was played disc golf but has never watched disc golf.
Yeah.
If you show them a Jomez Lee card video and then you show them a Gatekeeper or a GK Pro Lee card video, are they going to be able to tell a drastic difference?
Drastic, no. No. I mean, that's what they enjoyed more is realistically going to come down to the commentary and play more than anything.
Because this is where I think...
But one thing that needs to be said, though, is a lot of what makes GK Pro and Gatekeeper and a lot of their coverage great has been pulled and imitated and copied, not directly copied, from but, Jomez, you know... Yeah, sure. From Jomez. And so Jomez...
They're leading the way.
Exactly. But they've innovated new things for disc golf that other media companies then take and apply to their videos that make it to where now, yeah, you can watch any of them and you're happy with them all.
So I think I'm trying to think from like my standpoint of watching sports. Because we have to kind of relate Jomez, Gatekeeper, all these to like the ABCs, the CBSs, the NBCs, the TNTs, the ESPNs, right? When a basketball game, I'm just going to use basketball. When a basketball game is on, let's say, NBC versus a basketball game being on TNT, the only reason that I enjoy it being on TNT more commentators in basketball, I don't really care too much about. Same with football. I'm not, when it comes to commentating, like some people think Tony Romo is super annoying now. I don't really care too much with the commentators in football. I think they're all pretty decent. Basketball, same thing. But I know when it's TNT, I get the halftime show with Ernie, with Shaq, with Chuck,
yeah,
and Kenny, right? And I get the post game with those people as well. And so I get excited when I'm going to watch a basketball game on TNT because that comes. I think what Jomez has done, which of why you're saying like the Disc Golf Pro Tour is super smart about bringing them on board for 2 years because they're worried about the backlash. I don't, and maybe I'm wrong, don't really see that happening in other sports of where if the NFL came out and said, hey, NBC is going to be covering all of our games and not CBS and Fox. I don't think you're going to have a bunch of people come out and get super upset about games not being on CBS and Fox. Maybe some people that are like big fans of certain commentators, but no one's going to be like, oh my gosh, you guys are screwing CBS. What the heck? There's no one really like fans of CBS. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
But Jomez has put a face, has put a personality, and one of the reasons why they have become so successful is has done a great job of personalizing their company to where people actually have like emotional attachments to Jomez. And that's why I think you'll see in the comments and stuff, some people saying that GK Pro and Gatekeeper are terrible compared to Jomez, where if you actually had an unbiased person sit down and look at, you know, production and just look at who does it better than who, I think it'd be a lot closer than what some people are saying. And that's simply just because some people are fans of Jomez, where I've never heard anyone say that they're a fan of NBC. I don't see people walking around with NBC hats. I don't.
Yeah.
And so that's where I think there's this weird kind of connection with Jomez and doing coverage is,
well, it's just different though, because NBC, what you just described is like, I am personally a fan of college basketball in the ACC. So I don't care what channel I consume the ACC on. It's all the same to me. I'm going to watch the ACC. The difference in disc golf is the Pro Tour didn't exist until 2016. Or something like that. Yeah, 2016 was the start of the Pro Tour. Pro Tour didn't exist before then. Jomez, in 2012, when they started, there wasn't really a ton of ways to watch good quality disc golf. Like, you could watch, like, there was some live, I think, like, Disc Golf Planet. I wasn't watching disc golf back in 2012, but, you know, Smashbox, I think, was around back then. There was a few different ways, but, like, post-produced coverage wasn't a super big thing. Early in it, you can find, like, Marty McFly, and then he did with Prodigy with, like, no commentary, stuff like that. But Jomez, as the years went on, was your source, especially on, like, the tour. But, like, the tour still at that point wasn't like super, super established as a unified tour. If there was a massive A tier that Paul and Ricky and whoever went to, Jomez was there and covered it. It felt the same as a tour event because there wasn't a tour to be a fan of. You were just a fan of disc golf, and the only way to consume disc golf was through Jomez. That was that. So in that, instead of becoming allegiant to the ACC like I am, or allegiant to the NFL or the NBA, the only thing to attach yourself to was Jomez. Because your only other option was the PGA, but they were just sanctioning stuff. And so, like,
and again, like, I don't have anything against what Jomez is doing or anything like that. I think obviously they have done incredible things. I just think it is a weird, I'm just bringing this up because of the fact that you said, you know, they're worried about the backlash. It is a weird thing for the Disc Golf Pro Tour, because if the Disc Golf Pro Tour wants to continue to build, and if disc golf fans and all that stuff want the sport to continue to grow as far as more people playing, more money to pros, all that, you have to eventually phase out Jomez, Gatekeeper, and GK Pro as far as coverage. You have to, because I mean, it's I don't see how that happens in the sport. I don't see how that happens without the big dogs coming into play. And if ESPN comes in and says, we want complete rights to all coverage.
Sure, yeah.
And they're willing to spend $5 million.
Yeah, then it's...
That would drastically help the Disc Golf Pro Tour grow. The pros make more money and more eyeballs get to see it.
Yeah.
Right? So that's like everything. So I just don't see how that happens in the future. And it's just one of those things of where... we'll worry about it if it ever does happen, because this is all assuming that disc golf gets popular enough and more eyeballs get seen to where a big media company wants to pay all this media for all the media rights.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll cross that bridge when it gets there. But the question is like, are there going to be people that are upset at the Disc Golf Pro Tour, and are they going to call them sellouts and all this stuff for doing something that is clearly a business move that literally has been done hundreds and thousands of times before? But like you said, it's a weird situation with how Jomez got with disc golf and how a lot of fans have been brought into disc golf that is different. So
yeah,
it's just something to think about. Something to think about.
But, I mean, if ESPN came in tomorrow and bought all the coverage rights for $5 million, and there is no more post-production on YouTube unless it's through ESPN or the Disc Golf Network, like, there's only like going to be highlights posted and you have to watch it on ESPN. Yeah, people would boycott the Pro Tour. Players, I don't think, would, because players would understand how many more eyeballs they're reaching. But fans would be outraged 100%. Whether or not that's right or not, it is what it is, because like you said, $5 million a year to the Pro Tour, a very arbitrary number that we definitely just made up 100%. But something like that comes into the Pro Tour, there's no telling what that does for the sport and for the purses and for the exposure and stuff like that. But that's, at the end of the day, people are going to be upset because people are upset. But I think the tipping point to get where like that's not true or it's not a quote-unquote big deal is like if it ever... I don't even know how this exactly happens. I think it's starting to happen a little bit, but it's nowhere close. Is like the Pro Tour needs to be the most recognizable name in disc golf versus Jomez when it comes to like things beyond players. Because like right now, like, you know, NBA, MLB, all of that. And there's people who know NBA that have no idea who CBS is or TNT. There's people in other countries that know what the NBA is. They don't know TNT or whatever in correlation to the NBA. They couldn't tell you what network carries. I couldn't tell you. If I'm going to watch a game, I have no idea what it's coming on. I just know there's an NBA game on, and then I go find where it's at. Because the NBA, when it comes to basketball, is a bigger name than CBS or Fox or TNT or anything like that. And in disc golf, in order for that backlash to not happen, the Pro Tour would have to get to a point somehow that the Pro Tour is the bigger name in disc golf than Jomez. How that ever happens, I don't know. That's why I think the Pro Tour was geniuses for this move. And I think it benefits all sides and the sport. And I also think it was very smart for them to only do 2 years, because it gives enough security to Jomez, but it also gives enough negotiating power with the Pro Tour to not lock them into like 5-6 years and really screw themselves over. And it wouldn't surprise me if in the contract there is some type of clause, like a big media clause, where if someone comes in, the Pro Tour has the right to sell it or something like that.
To buy them out. Yeah. I mean, again, we're nowhere near the numbers that need to be hit for big media companies to have any sort of interest. But who knows? Like, if another big jump happens, who knows? The one thing I will finish on saying is I see this and hear this a lot, of like how Jomez has basically put disc golf on the map or did all this other stuff, right? Of where like everyone should be thankful for Jomez. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be thankful. I agree that you should. But also we have to keep in mind too that the players that they were filming, that's what people were tuning in to watch. And they've done a good job now of building up Yuli, Nate Sexton, and Big Germ as to be kind of like synonymous with Jomez, right? When you think of Jomez, you think of those guys as well. So they've done a good job about that. But at the end of the day, like, the people that Jomez was filming, and like you said, they would go to tournaments that the best players would go to, right? That's what you said, like, when they first were filming?
Yeah.
I just don't want people to forget, like, at the end of the day, like, people are tuning in, not because it's Jomez, but because of the people that are playing. And people will tune out.
Well, sure, but you also, like, on the flip side of that coin, if it wasn't for Jomez, or, like, anyone who would have stepped up, then these players would have had no platform. So, like,
I'm not disagreeing. What I'm saying is, like, it's for both. Like, both people need to be thought about, not just one. That's all I'm saying.
Sure.
Is some people are, like, the players should be thankful for Jomez. The Jomez should be thankful for the players, and the fans should be thankful for the both. And I think at the end of the day, this is a great deal for Jomez. This is a great deal for the Disc Golf Pro Tour. This is a great deal for the players. And it's going to continue to push disc golf in the right direction.
Boom. Perfect way to sum it up there. All right. We got so if you're listening, you haven't seen on Twitter or anything like that, we have a slightly new way that we're testing out tonight to get some debate topics from you at home. If you're listening on audio, you can still participate in this. You don't have to do it live. That's the best part of it. Downside, we can't debate directly with you. But this is the best solution we've come up right now. So if you head over to fdnsports.com, that's FDN.
I'll put it in the chat.
Boom. fdnsports.com. You can go to the tab at the top that says podcasts and then hit debate night. Right up top there, you will see plays that you can record an audio message for us. That will come to us, and it just sits in our inbox. And so we can go through, sort through them, and pick out the ones that we know will spark debate or at least be like something funny to play on the show or something we haven't thought of. I have a few starred tonight that we'll go through, and then you can submit these whenever you want. And I'll listen to all the ones that come in between today and next week's episode and sort through those and have some more for next week. And that's kind of how we're going to function until we can find the best solution when Brody's remote to still have him be able to work with the call-ins. So Silas, are we ready for my phone to play some stuff? Okay, he gave me a thumbs up. Yeah, I can't see Silas. All I can see is these lights in front of me and this camera. I'm literally looking at an exit door.
Sorry, I forgot I had a mic.
Yeah, I'm literally looking at an exit door and a poster of like Paul Bowl Cut Paul and Dynamic Disc Nico from 2008 USDGC. That's what I'm staring at right now. This whole show, it's great. I love it. So this first one is from Nate. Let's go ahead and play it.
What's up, fellas? My name is Nate. I'm calling in from Akron, Ohio. So I'm originally from Medina County, which is where Ricky Wysocki and Avery Jenkins played for a long time and might consider home, even though they've, I think, moved to the Carolinas by now. But it got me thinking, what in your guys' opinion are the best states or regions from like a disc golf scene standpoint? I thought you could talk about like their like courses in those areas, the communities, and then the professionals that originally are from those regions. Obviously, I don't think Northeast Ohio would be the best, but we're pretty fortunate up here. Some places that come to mind would be like New England, Michigan, the Carolinas, where you guys are from, and Virginia. Just would love to see what your guys' thoughts are on this, and as a good debate topic. So
there you have it. Thanks for calling in, Nate. I'm going to go ahead and start off. I think there's two that came to my mind as soon as I heard this topic of like best regions for a number of different facets. I think professional wise, at least up until like very recently, it always seemed like the top pros or a lot of the big names in the sport came out of California, and there was a lot of great courses in California. As far as like specific region, I don't know California well enough. We'll just go with like the Huntington Beach area because I know that's where Paul was from, and I know that he had connections with like Steve Rico and Shasta Chris and all the OGs in that area. I'm missing so many names right now. But a lot of those people, you know, all California, a lot of great courses in California. And then the other one is on the opposite side of the coast or of the country in Charlotte, North Carolina. I think that's a very obvious one, mainly for the amount of quality courses there. And then you have had a lot of notable pros come out of there. Big Germ being a big one. I would assume Yuli probably calls Charlotte home now, although he's technically, I believe, from Arizona. I'm not great with where pros are like originally from, but I know a lot of pros call Charlotte home now. So to me, Charlotte and California were like two big ones that stuck out. But Brody, you might not be able to talk about like ones that stick out for players, but like maybe in your touring, what have you noticed like community and courses wise?
I would say as far as like outside of Texas and Florida, right? Those are the two places that I've spent a lot of time.
Florida's a great one.
Yeah, Tampa is starting to become quite a spot. I was just down there recently, and there's a lot of pros down there, a lot of courses. And then obviously Texas, there's tons of good players and good courses in the Dallas area and in Austin as well. But I would say out of all the courses that I've been to on tour so far, the community side, I guess you will say, that pops out to me the most is Des Moines,
which interesting.
You might not think about, but that tournament I felt like had some of the loudest fans, had some of the most fans, a crazy amount of volunteers coming out to try to make that course look as good as possible. They would be right there at the top of my list. I haven't played any other courses than the, I think it's Pickard Park, I believe is actually what the course is, but it was incredible. And I'm look, oh, the other one too. The other one is Clash of Canyons in outside of Chicago. Where is that?
That's Illinois.
It's in Illinois, but Delwood. Outside of Chicago. Delwood. Is that the city?
That's the disc golf club. I don't know what that's named for.
They were nuts as well.
Yeah,
they have an incredible community there that loves disc golf, a crazy pro shop, really fun course, really well done tournament. So those two would be of the tournaments I've played so far, those two like jump out. Oh, Lockport. That's what it is. Lockport.
Yeah.
Those two jump out at me.
That's something I didn't even think of with this question, is like the loudest fans and stuff like you hear of like iconic stadiums to play in and stuff like that because the home fans are crazy. Like that, mm-hmm. That's something that's kind of cool. Like it's starting to develop where you have like MVP is known for like the 8 holes and stuff like that, to where like tournaments can get identities from their fans. So like eventually mm-hmm. You'll have a tournament that's like, oh man, when we go to that, like I can't wait to go to that course. The fans are crazy there.
So loud or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool. I didn't even think about that side being a possibility. I would let Silas answer, but Silas, I'm pretty sure you're only experienced in the Lynchburg community, eh?
Yeah, that's so, about it.
All right, well, the Lynchburg community, I mean, pretty great.
It's pretty great, man.
Yeah, there's not a lot to complain about.
There's a lot of courses around here. A
lot of courses. Our local club has grown like crazy. Huge shout out to the board. A lot of guys there are doing some great stuff in this area. And, you know, maybe one day we'll be one of those crazy loud towns that people remember on tour. But for right now, it is what it is. This next one,
I see Silas bringing the cowbell. Silas is
yes,
the cowbell type.
Silas
guy.
The cowbell. We need more cowbell, you know. And Silas, Silas is the only one that can deliver us. This next guy, I believe this is like the wild card one for tonight, if I'm remembering right. This is from Chase.
Popeyes is better than Chick-fil-A.
That's it. Oh, you want me to replay it? Did you get it? Replay it.
Popeyes is better than Chick-fil-A.
There's the topic. Chase McMillan claims Popeyes is better than Chick-fil-A. I'm going to have to defer to you, Brody, because
do you agree or disagree?
Well, I can't eat Popeyes. I've never been able to have Popeyes because they fry their chicken in lard, and I'm allergic to red meat and therefore allergic to lard. So Chick-fil-A's better in that sense because they fry in peanut oil.
All right, Hunter, here we go.
Hunter has no opinion.
Yeah, I can't have an opinion.
Well,
I never had
that
both.
No, because that means Chick-fil-A is better.
Chick-fil-A's better to me because it won't kill me, sure, but I can't tell you which one.
So that's one vote.
I can't tell you which one tastes better.
All right.
No.
Okay, I've had both.
No, mine doesn't count. I don't count.
Okay, we just had a Popeyes open up in Lynchburg, if you didn't know. About a little while ago. Anyway, Chick-fil-A takes the dub
No.
Chick-fil-A takes the dub.
What are you basing it on? What meal? Are we going just like straight chicken sandwich?
Straight chicken sandwich. Okay, the original chicken sandwich.
That's the way to do it. I agree.
Yeah.
Go off chicken
sandwich.
They both
have it. They both have their own way of making it, and Chick-fil-A's is superior.
Have you had Zaxby's chicken sandwich?
Yeah.
Chick-fil-A superior?
Chick-fil-A's still superior.
I agree.
Zaxby's is second. Popeye's is third.
The only one that's close is Raising Cane's, just because the box meal is incredible. Like the garlic bread, the fries, and then their chicken fingers is a incredible meal. But they don't have sandwiches.
The first time I had Zaxby's chicken sandwich, their wings are good. Zaxby's chicken fingers or tenders, whatever you want to call them, absolutely suck. They're the most inconsistent thing on earth.
Not good.
Sometimes they're incredible. Other times, you might as well be biting into a human finger. It's gross. Their chicken sandwich, though, first time I had it, I went with my wife because people had hyped it up to us. We bit into it, and I was like, this is it. This is the chicken sandwich that has dethroned Chick-fil-A. Then I took a friend back to Zaxby's like 2 days later. I was like, you've got to try this chicken sandwich. Got it. And it's just like their chicken tenders. It was awful. It was the worst chicken sandwich I ever had. So Zaxby's is just completely disqualified. Yeah. They're way too inconsistent.
The thing that Chick-fil-A has going for you is no matter where you are and no matter what time of day you go, what you're going to get is going to be exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like their consistency, I've never gotten cold fries. I've never gotten like weird like chicken that is like burnt or undercooked. I've never gotten anything at Chick-fil-A and been like, wow, this tastes different.
Yeah.
No matter where you are, as long as it's not Sunday, you know what you're going to get.
There you go. You know what you're getting on Sunday. It's no chicken.
Yeah, you're getting nothing.
You get nothing.
Hey, I will say though, KFC's chicken sandwich is pretty good. It's pretty good.
KFC is very underrated. Their popcorn chicken's incredible. I started eating it again recently. I've fallen in love with KFC. Colonel Sanders, he knows what's going on.
I'll definitely do this sounds like a great video that we should do.
Just like trying all the chicken.
Yeah, we buy a bunch of different chicken sandwiches all over the place, cut them in fours, and then we just taste test them and see what happens.
I love it. That's what I eat pretty much every day anyways. All right, back to some disc golf. We've got Jason with the next topic here.
This is Jason from New York, and my debate for you guys is, do you guys think that in the future the Disc Golf Pro Tour should make all courses like golf courses par, where the courses pars between 70 to 72, or do you guys like the mixture of par with lower par and more like par threes? Or I like kind of what we could possibly do is have more par fours and fives where it creates more score separation because more shots have to be thrown. And I'm just curious what your guys' feelings are on that, if you think that that would help the sport or if that would hurt the sport. I'm not saying that every course has to be a par 70 to 72, but it would be cool to see more courses that have that type of style of golf. I'm just curious on your guys' feelings. Thank you.
So there you have it. Jason wants our opinions on should disc golf par be pushing closer to golf par, that 70 to 72 range, or is like upper 50s, low 60s our sweet spot?
You want me to go first?
Yeah, I'm curious to hear your answer on this. I have what I think is my answer, but I'm curious what you're going to say.
So I think it would be best for the pars to increase only if the difficulty of those holes increases as well.
Yeah. Let's assume that it's not what happens sometimes where like a par four gets turned into a par three for no reason or vice versa. Let's assume that like the courses are proportionally getting harder or easier depending on what you're saying.
Because if you have a par four that is, let's say, 650 feet and players can throw pretty much whatever they want off the tee, you're going to have the guys that can throw 500 feet and then be able to throw the 150 up and down easy. And then you're going to have guys that throw 400 feet also can get up and down pretty easy from 250. The gap between 150 and 250 is not nearly as significant in golf or in disc golf as it is in golf, where like 100 yards to 150, like, or I just do 100 feet. So 100, let's do 150 yards to 180 yards. That's roughly about 100 feet. That is a massive gap. Someone's going to have a lot more birdie chances from 150 than they are from 180, where it's not the same from, you know, those distances that I just kind of gave out. So I think you got to make it to where landing zones off the tee shot are, you know, there's chances of you being able to go out of bounds and take a big number. Same with the upshots. There needs to be stuff like that to where ultimately if you can get a, let's just say it's a par four, if you can get a 3, 4, 5, or 6 on the hole, then I think increasing it, what you're going to see is you're going to see a lot more score set, like score changes, right? Like if you're coming into the round and you're like 6 or 7 back, you have the ability of going out there and shooting incredible because there's a lot more throws that have to be done. So if you have a good day, you have to throw. You know, you take out the putts, you know, you're throwing 36 shots, 40 shots, maybe 50 shots. I don't know exactly how many, but you're throwing, having to throw a lot of shots where some of these holes right now, some of these courses where the par is lower, you can just go out and throw 10, 12 good tee shots and score really well because there are so many par threes. So that's what I think is it's going to force better players to play better over longer periods of time.
So what
does that make sense?
Yeah. What was your like par number range again?
I definitely think I think there probably should be in golf. It's 4, 4, 8. So 4 par 5s, 4 par 3s, 8 par 4s. I think it should be 4 par 5s, like 4. Yeah, 4 par 5s. 5 or 6 par 4s, and then the rest par 3s. So I still think there probably should be more par 3s just because right now space, and also you can just create cooler shots and stuff when it's a par 3.
Yeah.
And I think disc golf is more of a par 3 style than just watching someone throw in like an open shot or I don't know.
No, yeah, I think I'm more, on the same wavelength.
Does that make sense? Like, I think there needs to be more par threes, but I think there needs to be like at least half should be fours and fives.
Yeah, that's where my head is. I'm in like the 64 to 68 range, so a little bit higher than where disc golf is now, but pushing towards like that golf 70, 72 range par. So like, I think like 68 is a pretty good sweet spot. It depends a lot on the course. But like what you were saying is in disc golf, I think that par threes provide like a unique type of scoring separation that par fours, you can have like a par three. If it's a 400-foot par three, someone who throws 320 isn't birdieing it. Now, obviously, that person's not on tour if they throw 320. But if you all of a sudden have a 650-foot par three, now that person that throws 320 could possibly birdie it. And the person that throws 450 is birding it easily. So no matter how hard you make par fours or par fives, it gets easier for people to birdie the more, like, it's still very difficult because they have to execute more shots, but the possibilities there more so. Whereas a par three, you can add more difficulty to the line and distance and create scoring separation that way a little bit as well. So that's where I think that there should be more par threes than just in golf. In disc golf, because I just, it makes more sense the way the sport's laid out, because you also, par in disc golf just isn't par in golf, because golf, it's very true of like on the green and then two putts. In disc golf, that's just not the case. And so I don't think we should get so, I don't even think we should get so stuck up on par. I think we should get a lot more stuck up on like the separation from first place to 10th place and how quickly that can flip flop. I don't think it necessarily matters what number's next to their name, as long as it's not just like everyone's super easy and there's not going to be a big blow up. Like, that's a bad course if like a player can't blow up and they can shoot, they like, everyone's within a certain range. You want wide ranges so that players can shoot hot and the same players can blow up. So then there's always drama. I think it doesn't matter what numbers those are. It just tends to make more sense for those numbers to be closer to par for that to happen.
I would say two par threes. The reason why I would like to see more than the fours and the fives is the par threes, you really can force players to have to throw specific shots. So yeah. if you want to see the, you know, forehand hyzer flip stand up or the backhand turnover shot, it's much easier to force them to do that in a par three than making it. I mean, obviously, if you're in the woods, it's a little bit different. But you can set up the tee pad and you can set up the basket to where that forces that shot, where in a par four, players are going to land where they want in the fairways, essentially, to try to be able to throw the shot that they're comfortable with their second. But looking at the courses this week, you've got Infinite at a par 57, 7,115 feet. Factory, par 61, just under 9,000 feet. And Innova, par 61, 8,800 feet. So something to think about.
Yeah.
And Infinite, being the par 57, also is the easiest course out of all of them.
Yeah. In the caddy book, it described Infinite as the easiest, Factory Store as the longest, and Innova is the most challenging. And Innova is the one that y'all play twice.
I think Factory can be challenging if there's wind. If there's no wind, then Innova is definitely a harder course. But Factory in the wind, because there are some very demanding tee shots that require distance, Factory is difficult.
Nice. Yeah, wind always plays some type of factor. But what you said about par threes, that's a great point I haven't really thought about, to where it's a lot easier to force a hole to be played, or at least strongly suggest a hole be played the way you want it to on a par three versus a par four. And so if you're a course designer, that actually – that makes a lot more sense. In disc golf, I mean, with shot shaping and trying to get like a more technical shot on a par four, there's a lot more option for player to go short on their first, long on their second, or long on their first, short on their second, or hyzer layup and then go forward and stuff like that. Whereas a par three, it's like if you're a top player, you got to get to the basket. So you got to figure out the easiest way to get there, and you can kind of choose what that is as a course designer. I've actually never thought of it from that side of the coin, of how much more control you can have over the par three. We're gonna go with one more call in or a voice memo for tonight. We have a few more that have come in since the show, so I'll be able to go through those between now and next week and pick out some of the best ones. But this one, final one, I actually don't remember what this one is at all, but I put a star next to it, which means I picked it for the show, so we'll see what it is. It's from Jordan.
Hey guys, my name is Jordan. I have an idea that I'd like for you guys to discuss and debate. Similar to the news that just came out about Jomez paying the Pro Tour for the rights to do post-production, I think manufacturers should have to pay the Pro Tour for the right for their discs to be able to be thrown on the tour. Just an idea of how this all could work. There could be a yearly fee required by the Pro Tour for manufacturers. Let's say it's something, this could be high, but let's say $500,000 per manufacturer. The nine major manufacturers, I think, could all accommodate this. The nine being Discraft, Innova, MVP, the three from Trilogy, Prodigy, Discmania, Infinite. And what this would do is if you took that $4.5 million and split it over the 20 Pro Tour events, that gives you $225,000 of added cash per event. I think you would also want to front load the payouts a little bit, meaning I pay the top 20 really heavily and then drop it off pretty steeply after that. I did some just quick calculations using Kyle Klein as an example. In my simulations, I had first place getting $50,000, second place getting $30,000, third getting $20,000. Fourth getting 15, fifth getting 12, and then it drops off pretty steep from there. But using those numbers, Kyle would have made about $160,000 last year just from payouts alone. I think this would be much more entertaining and better for the sport if players' compensation was more directly tied to winnings from purses and not necessarily just from royalties and deals with manufacturers.
All right, so a lot in there. I think there's kind of two parts that we can look at separately. The first one, though, we got to talk through is the idea of manufacturers having to pay a fee.
What are we talking about right now? We got to talk about this?
I mean, I just want to hear you. I want to hear your, because your initial gut reaction to manufacturers having to pay a fee for
why are we talking about it?
For their disc
to
be thrown.
Why are we talking about this?
I don't know. I thought it was funny. I thought it was a funny idea.
What?
I mean,
in what world?
I don't know. The only thing I could think of like logically would this ever happen is like if the manufacturer paid X, Y, or Z fee, the commentator then said the disc's name versus if you didn't pay the fee, then the commentator said mid-range or whatever. That was the only thing of like where that would make sense because it's essentially it would almost be a reapproval process of like a manufacturer had to go through Pro Tour approval and pay. But the secondary thing is obviously the one to talk about of front loading, making the top 20 have the higher payout and focusing more so on that. And I like that he brought data of how much it would have made a difference for Kyle Kline's season last year and kind of what it would look like there.
We do appreciate all callers, but if someone calls in and says something
nonsensical.
What that word is? That whimsical. Should be a word.
No,
it's definitely not whimsical. But we got to be fair. We got to call everything like we see it.
Absolutely.
And the first portion of that, absolutely not. What needs to happen is there needs to be outside sponsors. We've talked about this many, many times. There needs to be outside sponsors outside of just the disc manufacturers sponsoring these events. And that way, all the manufacturers are wanting to put money, ads, all that stuff into the events.
Yeah.
That needs to happen. For example, this tournament in Vegas is run by Innova. Guess who's not here? Discraft.
Yeah.
Discmania. Prodigy. MVP. All these companies are not here. Now, will they pay for ads to be run during coverage? Probably. But are they paying? Well, that's actually an interesting question. Are they paying ads to be run during coverage?
They'd be paying to the Disc Golf Network for the ads to go during coverage. But I'm not sure. Innova might pay the Disc Golf Network for exclusive rights to that or something.
I guess we'll see. Because ultimately, that's going to be where the most money is the ad spend on the coverage. The question, I guess, is like, is Discraft and stuff paying for the post-produced ads? Regardless, that's what needs to happen. Front-loading, just to wrap it up, front-loading, I don't mind that idea. I'm also a firm believer that if you're broke and you're out on tour, and winning $150 versus $125 is like life and death situation, you should probably reevaluate what you're doing. And that's just coming from someone just that's been broke and poor himself. If you're not making enough money to like pay your bills, you probably need to find a different thing. So we shouldn't be really worrying about people making $125 instead of $150. What you should really be doing too, and this will also entice those people that are down in that low cash range, it would entice them to practice and to try to get better or whatnot, because if they do go out and have a great tour, a great finish at an event, you would want that to be a huge number. And it would suck if you've been, you know, 50th and 40th, you're barely cashing and you're making a little bit of money, and then all of a sudden you get 20th. And the change between 45th and 20th is not that drastic. So that's what I'll say on that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that the people who disagree with you, I think, have a different view of the Pro Tour from what I've read and understood. And to me, what it comes down to is what needs to be understood is the Pro Tour is not an employer. A player playing on the Pro Tour has no right to money from the Pro Tour. The Pro Tour is not an employment agreement with them. None of that. Like, you as a player on tour are not an employee of the Pro Tour. You don't report to and work for Jeff Springs. You are paying to be able to participate in a competition that is called the Pro Tour. And so week in and week out, your play directly determines your compensation based on that play. So whenever this is suggested, it's not like, oh, but you're cutting the pay of whatever. It's like, no, they're not employees. It's not like you're taking a social media manager and then they come in the next day and you're like, hey, you know, sorry, that post only got 30 likes. Instead of you making 40 grand this year, you're only going to make 20 now. Like, that's not, it's not, you can't take it and copy and paste it into a normal business world, because this is a competition. It's what it is. You aren't mad when you enter a poker tournament and you walk away with no money and the winner got $50,000. You're not mad at that because you know what you were getting yourself into when you entered the poker tournament.
That's what we're doing right now. We're basically playing poker, right? Because everyone's paying these very high tournament fees to play in these events. And tournament, if you took out the money that goes into the purse because of players' fees, the purses all of a sudden become very small, right? Like they become drastically smaller. So we are playing basically poker in the sense of where you are betting on yourself to try to win other people's money.
Yeah. Eventually, and imagine how mad you'd be if you showed up to poker night and me, you, Silas, and Trevor are all playing poker and we all put 50 bucks in and you win poker night. And so there's 200 bucks in there and you get 75 or you get 100 of it. And then Trevor got 75 and I get my $50 back or whatever. And Silas gets 25 bucks, whatever's left over. Like, you'd be ticked. You're like, we all paid 50 bucks. I played poker and I won. I should get like at least 175 and give the second person 25 or something. Like, we knew what we were getting ourselves into.
It is what it is. And I think right now the Disc Golf Pro Tour is still obviously having to have players pay to get in.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, it will get to the point of where there will be that mutual contract between the Disc Golf Pro Tour and the players of where it's like, we know that you bring value into the tour and we're basically going out and trying to sell these events because of you. And so then players don't have to pay. So, like, right now, we're still in the baby stages.
I don't know about that.
Where players have to pay.
Don't players still have to pay on the PGA Tour?
No.
How positive are you?
100%. All they pay is for locker rooms fees, and that goes to the club.
Oh, okay. Okay. So they do pay per tournament.
$50 for locker room fees, probably. And that goes to the club. That doesn't go to the PGA Tour.
Gotcha. So they don't have to pay anything for, like, So a professional golfer, PGA Tour player, is exempt from qualifying, doesn't have to pay entry fees. He pays $100 initiation fee and then $100 in annual dues. The only expense he must pay to play in a tournament is a $50 locker room fee. So basically what you just said. But
yeah, and the $100 too, like that's not, those fees for those $100 are not going to purses. Those are going to probably help run like the players' union, whatever, like stuff that.
But that's also just an annual fee. That's an annual fee. I mean, I saw the
it's also $100.
Yeah, the cost for Las Vegas Challenge this weekend, I think, was $325.
Yeah, so we're paying more money to play in the Las Vegas Challenge than a PGA Tour player is paying to play on tour.
Yeah,
For the entire year. But again, that will come in time when the Disc Golf Pro Tour is getting enough money from sponsorships and all this stuff to then be like, hey, players, you're on tour. We don't need you to pay these tournament fees anymore. And then that'll be a little bit different.
Well, and also, whenever this conversation gets brought up, there's people in the comment section or wherever that Reddit threads and all this stuff that are like, that's not how you should be looking at it. Players aren't in this for the love of money. They're in it for the love of the game and blah, blah, blah. And we need to make sure that as many players can be on tour as possible. In today's
day, they better be in it for the money if they're trying to make this their living.
Well, this is what I was going to say.
This is what they want to do for their job. Yeah,
that's what they're saying. Is like they're like, they care about winning, not about the amount of money they got for winning, is what people will say in response. Right now, I understand it because we need to fill the tour. We need to fill the field week in and week out. Realistically, we're probably at a point where that doesn't matter anymore. The fields are going to fill. But let's look at it this way. If every player on tour is just in it for the love of the game and they don't care about the money and stuff like that from contracts, First off, caring about the money from a contract, that doesn't matter. Let's take a step back one more time to get a bigger picture. If you and I were going to go race outside 100 yards and it was just for the pride of who won, and then on the next day you're like, hey, let's race 100 yards, but this time the winner gets $6,000. I care a lot more about the second race. Not because I'm greedy and love money, but because the first one, like, just winning doesn't mean nearly as much to me as much as $6,000 does. That's just a natural fact, and if someone disagrees with that, it is what it is. Maybe they're way more competitive than me. But I think a perfect example of this is look at player social media. You go back a few years, no player was on social media. So if the players truly loved social media and they were doing it for the love of social media and nothing about growing their brand and money.
They love their fans.
But if that's true, if they love their, which they do, but I'm just saying if social media and stuff is for the love of the fans and not for growing a brand, marketability, sponsorship contracts, and at the end of the day, money, then why 8, 9, what, however many years ago, 5 years ago even, 3 years ago even, some players too, why weren't they doing it if that's what they loved? It's because at the end of the day, this is a business for them. This is a business for everyone. And so at the end of the day, they're doing the things that are going to put them in position to make the most money. And so therefore, they might end up doing things they don't love. And also, as soon as you put X amount of money for first place, second place gets this, third place gets this, and you know, hey, if I finish outside the top 20, I'm only getting a few hundred bucks. But if I finish inside the top 10, I'm guaranteeing at least $1,000. And if I win, I get 10 grand. There's more motivation to put more effort into playing, which I think is what's going to grow the sport, is players need to be concerned about what they're doing on the course to earn a living. And right now, a lot of the focus is what they can do off the course, which is great. But having players go all in and, you know, grind and be able to get to push disc golf to a new level is what's going to draw more and more new fans, as like you have players doing crazy stuff week in and week out. And a lot of that does come from money in the purses going to the right places instead of just, you know, the extra $150 here and there towards the bottom. Like I said, this weekend's a great example. You could have $10,000 instead of $4,000 with the same amount of money in the purse. Is what it is.
I think there's a lot of people, I don't know. I'm definitely not in the realm of some people where they're like, we need can't grow too fast, or we don't want people making too much money, because then, like, at the end of the day, man, if these people are out putting on a show and making the Disc Golf Network, making Jomez, making all these other companies a lot of money, then the pro should be making money as well.
Yes.
Like, it shouldn't just be all the companies making money off the players.
No.
It should be the pros should be making money as well. Now, obviously, Discraft, Innova, Prodigy, all those companies are going to always make way more. Like, the company as a whole is always going to make way more than a player.
Yeah.
That's just the nature of the beast. But, like, we need to try to get those numbers closer together. And I don't see how that's a bad thing. I think we want to entice more people to look at becoming a disc golf professional as not just a, oh, I can travel around the world or I can travel around the United States in my van for free. And when I'm done playing disc golf, I'll figure out what to do with my life, and I don't have any money in my savings account, and I'll just worry about it when I worry about it. Like, I don't think that's a really good idea. So,
well, like, who's quitting their, like, who is just getting into disc golf, extremely athletic? Which scenario are they considering it for a career? Are they considering it when you're like, hey, if you come in 48th place, you can win $300 week in and week out? Or, hey, if you win, you can get $10,000 week in and week out? Like, the second one sounds way more enticing than, like, yeah, I mean, you win, you get $4,000. But, hey, if you're able to cash, you're guaranteeing at least $300. Like, okay. Mm-hmm. Versus, hey, if you're able to get to the top of the sport, 10 grand, boom.
Maybe some people can go. We'll post the link again. Maybe some people can call in or go into the link and send some stuff for next week's show. I honestly just don't know how players making more money for winning. And again, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about players making more money because they're more famous.
No.
Or they got big more fans.
Just
we're talking
winning.
About players We're talking about what they do on the course, making more money. How does that make things worse? And there are people out there that think it does. And I would love to hear people call in, and maybe you can change my mind. I would love to hear people call in about how that makes things worse.
Yeah, it definitely is a fascinating question that I would also be curious to hear the other side on. But I think that about wraps it up. Best of luck out there, Brody, for this week. What's your tee time on Thursday? I saw they posted those.
I'm throwing up the twos for Tuesday. 2-2-2. Tee time is 12:36, I believe. 12:36. The Brody Tracker will be out.
Heck
yeah.
This
will be the first tournament where the Brody Tracker will be used without Trevor behind the helm. The person that will be doing it is my cousin, who is also going to be caddying for me as well. And he is doing his research right now. He's gone back and looked at Trevor's tweets when Trevor took over for Brody Tracker at USDGC. And then I also sent him Tiger Tracker, and he's going and researching that as well. So he will be primed and ready for this event. And this is also something that if you guys are going to be in the area of a tournament, I will potentially at some event, I'm going to have one of my buddies with me for some of the events too, and he'll be kind of running it. But at some events, I might not have anyone. So if there's someone out there that wants to stick around and watch me play and is interesting in it, let me know.
There you have it. And if you're interested in the tournament coming up this weekend and you want to learn more about what to expect, some storylines to follow, what it's going to take to win, our keys to victory, and all of our predictions and dark horse picks, all of that stuff that normally happens in the normal weekly Grip Locked. We're going to have the Grip Locked Las Vegas Challenge preview show tomorrow right here on YouTube and in the normal wherever you listen to Grip Locked audio. That'll be coming out tomorrow. We're not positive if we're going live or if it's just going to be posted mid-afternoon, so stay tuned for more details on that. We're going to test it out with this event, maybe the first few events, see how it goes, see how you like splitting Grip Locked into two different episodes on tournament week. Personally, I'm really excited for it because I think it gives us a lot more possibilities to like dive deep into the tournament and actually, you know, really do research on plenty of different storylines, the key stats that won it last year and how we think that's going to affect who's going to win it this year. All of that stuff that would have been a little too deep and spent too much time in one long Grip Locked episode, we can push it out in like a 30 to 40 minute Grip Locked episode previewing the tournaments. So I'm super excited for it. It's probably one of the more exciting newer podcasts, even though it's just Grip Locked on our channel. But yeah, Trevor and I will be taking that on tomorrow. So you can tune into that if you're interested.
I got one more thing to say too. Can we talk real quick?
Yeah, yeah.
Can we talk about how exciting this FPO feature card is going to be?
Oh, it's going to be incredible. We got Paige Pierce, Henna Blomroos, Evelina Solonen, and Kristen Tatar all teeing off at 9 o'clock in the morning their time, so 12 p.m. Eastern time, live on the Disc Golf Network. And you can also follow along on UDisc. It's the card the offseason hyped up. All year, all offseason, all we talked about was when the European women come over, you know, who knows what's going to happen, X, Y, and Z. It's time to put rubber meets. I wish they could have a five-person card so Katrina Allen could be in the mix too. But, you know, beggars can't be choosers. We get what we want here, and they're all going to be head-to-head right off the start. It's going to be thrilling.
The other thing that was really cool is when I was going through all the players to figure out what my tee time is, one thing that will be sweet too, saying in the future, if the Disc Golf Pro Tour can figure out how to text out, like max text out everyone's tee time, I'm sure the program, Silas, could probably come up with it. But that's how some, I mean, I've had golf tournaments that do that, and I know that's how the PGA Tour does it, of where they text you your tee time. Super awesome. If they can figure that out, that'd be sick. But for right now, you basically just, you know, sort by earliest to latest, and you start scrolling down and you're looking for your name, right? I will say this, and this is really exciting for disc golf. It is getting harder and harder to tell what is a feature card. Now, obviously, the feature cards for the most part, are normally at the very end, right? Like, that's obviously a given. But GK, Gatekeeper, Central Coast, they'll sometimes bounce and, well, and film a feature card earlier in the day.
Jomez will be earlier in the day, too, on day one.
Oh, sometimes as well? Okay. So
they don't cover the live card on day one.
Oh, that's right. So when you go through and you start looking at some of these cards, like there were multiple cards where I was like, oh, is that going to be filmed? And then like, oh, wait, is that one going to be filmed? Is that one going to? And that's just really exciting for disc golf that there are getting more and more players that are not just really good skill level, but also personality wise or just like fan favorites. Like there's more than ever, obviously, but it's exciting to kind of continue to see that growth of where instead of just people caring about one or two people or three people, there are now starting to get more and more names out there. And I think it's going to be, I mean, I think every year, I keep saying this each year I go into it, like every year is just really exciting. And, you know, I've gotten some really good practice rounds in with some people. And it's fun to be back out there playing with these guys. And I can't wait to see. I don't even want to say tee it up because I'm not teeing it up. What the heck am I saying?
Can't wait to throw it off with them.
Launch them. Can't wait to throw it with them on Thursday. That sounds sling so it. Much worse than tee
can't
up.
Wait to sling it.
Can't wait to sling them. Can't wait to sling them on Thursday.
There you go.
So should be fun. Can't wait. And, yeah, everyone tune in, Disc Golf Pro Tour Network, feature cards, then check out Jomez, Gatekeeper, GK Pro. They'll all be out here doing feature cards as well, and follow along with the Brody Tracker on Twitter.
There you have it. We'll talk to you all again next week.